If there's content that's borderline, that's content that we basically will not.
There is no second best. There is no second best crypto asset.
I respect you and I have a great deal of appreciation to you, JF.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to JFG Tonight. I've been watching Jurassic Park, and I thought there's lots to say about why this movie is good. I think a lot of the new screenwriters and directors, they suck. We've not had a good movie in a long while, and I think it's worth going back to Jurassic Park and understand why is this movie good, why is the structure interesting. End of the line, Joel says, Jeff, your game coding videos are good. Would you consider a live page composition video using Affinity for one of the extra pages you mentioned that you hope to include in the final White People Food book? I may not be making a video about me making a page from the cookbook because I'm pretty much done. At this point, I am in the final review stage. So now I'm at page 37 of my final review. It's a longer run, the final review, because there's lots of little things, links and all. But I could definitely do an example video showing you how to work pages in a cookbook, how to use the various features of Affinity. I've been learning a lot. It's a wonderful software. Affinity is very powerful and free, amazingly. These Adobe Photoshop thing and these alternatives like InDesign, they used to cost a lot. And I don't know why people were buying those, but eventually we converged toward a free, very high level editor with layers, with effects. I could show you everything about it now that I've gone through it. I've learned so much. Sometimes I was asking AI, how do I do this? How do I do that? And AI always knows. It always knows. We have a super chat that came during the night. New fan says, do you respond to questions/comments submitted between shows or only during streams? Well, thank you very much for the support. I do at the beginning of each show. If you've sent a super chat during the night on XChat, or on Streamlabs, I will see it in my interface, and generally I play them and answer them at the beginning of a show. So yes, feel free to send super chats while I'm offline. Jared Norman says, when will JF do a cooking show? Maybe. I can't exclude that this is a possibility. It's entirely possible. All right. Let's get started on Jurassic Park. The first reason Jurassic Park is so great and new movies suck is the character structure. And especially in Jurassic Park, everything is paired. And sometimes it's paired in a non-obvious way, sometimes it's paired in a very obvious way. It's very obvious that Dr. Grant and Dr. Sattler, they are a pair. They form a yin and a yang. And it's the male and female pair. It's the male and female archetype. That is an easy one. But there are other characters that are well paired in Jurassic Park. And it's a movie that was done by Spielberg from a book. And there are some differences between the book and the movie. First, in the movie, the old guy who makes the park, John Hammond, he is much more sympathetic. He is much more lovable in the movie than he is in the book. In the book, this old guy was a very greedy. So he was bringing greed into the whole scenario. Whereas in the movie, he is mostly narcissistic, but not overly greedy to the point of disliking his own grandchildren. But in the book, apparently, he gives little care about his grandchildren. Whereas in the movie, he's presented as still loving his grandchildren, but driven by a narcissistic quest that puts them in danger. So one of the first characters that is important, and the way these characters, they have advantages, they have their strength. All of these strengths will eventually lead them to a sin. So in Jurassic Park, every strength of a character is what leads them to either die or to fail at some point or to be subject to a possible path of redemption. And it's very good when you do this because new movies, they will just throw psychological features, random psychological features, sometimes the most random thing. Like, this person is gender diverse, this person is black, and he's got this attitude. But they will never recycle this in a whole character quest form that leads to errors that are in line with the original character features. So we want to see not only the advantages of a mode of thinking, but where it goes wrong. And Jurassic Park shows us where it goes wrong every time. Marby Dog says, except the mathematician. No, I mean, even the mathematician with his overly theoretical approach to the world eventually miscaptures reality. And that's the moment at which he ends up injuring his legs. Because when he sees Dr. Grant waving the light to the T-Rex and then he throws the light, Dr. Grant knows I need to stop moving so that the T-Rex goes straight to the light. What does Ian Malcolm do? He tries to copy this, but he does it in a way that is too theoretical. He forgot to fully copy the behavior. What does that lead to? A misapprehension of what Dr. Grant was doing. So he ends up with the flare, but instead of throwing the flare and staying in place, he's driven by his fear, by his inability to interact with the pragmatic real world that he's stuck in. And it leads him to be chased by the T-Rex. So sometimes when you have an approach that is too theoretical, even the mathematician in Jurassic Park ends up making an excess of this. George says, narcissist is all bollocks. I'm supposed to have no empathy by diagnosis. I love my dog. It's all rubbish. Well, calm down, George. I wasn't talking about you. I was talking about John Hammond. Anyways, let's get started on the characters. So one character that is key in this movie is the ranger. This is a man who knows via instinct and behavioral observation. So you have different ways to approach reality in Jurassic Park. And this guy is like a dog trainer, like a hunter, like a safari type of guy. He collects all of these personalities together. But in the end, he interacts with the dinosaurs, not from a theoretical perspective, but from a military and constantly practical perspective. So this ranger has extreme acuity in observation. And it's also what's going to lead him to an excess. Because Dr. Grant knows the Velociraptors good enough that he knows the Velociraptors will be hunting you in triples. This guy has probably more visual acuity and military understanding than Dr. Grant, but he fails because he doesn't know that. So what does he do when he gets killed eventually by a Velociraptor? He's too attentive to one of the Velociraptors. He's like, I got you. He's got his gun. He's got all of the strategies laid out, but he doesn't have the knowledge of there are two Velociraptors coming from your two sides. Dr. Grant would know this. This guy doesn't know. So one thing that enriches a movie from the start is asymmetry of knowledge. It's like the public knows there's three velociraptors, so they will be hunting you in a group. Dr. Grant said it at the beginning of the movie. But the ranger doesn't know. The ranger is sinning by too much observation. And because he's so good at observing, he's focused on one velociraptor. He knows everything about it. He sees her movement. He's ready to defend himself with his gun. But that's not enough. Too much observation is also a failure to observe your sides. And this is what will lead him into excess. He sees the animals for who they are. And he understands their lethal capacity. Because when the movie starts, it's the first thing you see. It's his trauma from the fact that one velociraptor at some point escaped the cage. And he was still in the cage, but he was able to grab a human and kill him, one of the employees. So this entering scene is very important to frame his trauma. And to say, okay, this guy has seen the death that can be seeded by dinosaurs. So this entry scene is telling you there were signs already of problems. There were signs that they were doing something extremely dangerous. And it's quite interesting because everything is about hacking in this movie. So the Velociraptor has hacked a human flaw in their transfer system from transport cage to cage for the Velociraptor. What does the Velociraptor know? There's a moment. There's a moment at which both locks have to be unlocked, and there's a moment at which the lights are off, and that's his moment to act. That's her moment to act. So the Velociraptor sees that moment and kicks in, displacing the transport cage, leading to the fact that he can grab a human. Now, this is an early sign in this movie that the theme is all going to be about hackable structures, flaws, exploitability. And everything about the movie is about it. Marby Dog says, this movie also supports your theory about gene manipulation. JF, TRP strikes again. Absolutely. It's a kind of an early warning about genetic modifications. And back then, we wouldn't call it genetic modification. We would call it genetic cloning. But that was the technology back then. Today, we would talk more of CRISPR. And yes, it's absolutely... If they had known the theory of phenotypic revolutions, it could have been a better movie. It could have been more intense. Unfortunately, they didn't know. Because I was 6 years old and I was sitting in the freaking cinema watching the movie. a second character, and this one is paired, very interestingly. So it's Dennis, the fat coder. So Dennis is incarnating in this movie greed. Greed and gluttony. So he had to be fat for the role to work. He had to be selected as fat because fat, ultimately gluttony, is greed in the domain of food. And so this guy feels that he should have more money than he's given. This guy feels that he's not being paid enough by Hammond. He has set up the whole system of control of the park. And he is... His name is Dennis Nedry. So the fat guy wants more. And his greed is different from the greed of the liar. So there's two types of greed in Jurassic Park. So that's he's in financial troubles. And his plan for enrichment is betrayal through piracy, basically. So he wants to steal the knowledge from Jurassic Park and give it to another company. He arranges this meeting at the beginning where he's with the corporate competitor who want to have access to the dino embryos. And he's going to just do piracy. He's just going to mess the system up, leave Jurassic Park, and run away with the most embryos he can to bring them to the competitor. So that's greed of the kind of illegal kind, of the corporate espionage kind. End of the line, Joel says, Jurassic Park taught me Unix. Yes, the security system is on Unix. And yeah, when you're in the 90s and you're a young kid and you see, wow, hackers, wow, Unix, what is this? What is this computer system? And yes, it does push you. What is it? I need to learn about this. And yes, I was so fascinated by Linux because I didn't have access to it then. And but there was all this talk that, yes, pros, they all use Linux. And I was like, how does one even install Linux? Where does one get it? Yes, that was my childhood. And Jurassic Park, I noted the mention back then. It influenced me a lot. So that's one type of greed. Now we have a second type of greed in Donald Gennaro. So Donald Gennaro is the liar. It's the greedy liar. Well, the image is not coming out right now, but you can see the various images. This guy at first is there to audit Jurassic Park, and he's like, we have a lot of doubts, and where your investors are going to drop you under the bus, and we don't think it's safe. But very quick, he sees the opportunity for enrichment. So interestingly, this guy is thin, as opposed to the fat coder who is fat. And he had to be thin because he was in the duality. He was put in the duality with Dennis, in that he is greedy, but in a within system way. So Dennis wants to do piracy. He wants to steal embryos. This liar is so greedy that he wants everything to be safe so that he can make money. So he's introduced in various as being somewhat dishonest or kind of so greedy that he doesn't care about nature. He says, you know, that we'll have coupon days when people start being worried about, will Jurassic Park be accessible to the poor? Well, maybe we can have a coupon day, meaning the other 364 days of the year, we should be cashing in on this stuff. So he's into the greed of enrichment through exploitation of the natural world and through gatekeeping. Because what is Jurassic Park? Ultimately, it's a big gatekeep operation. It's a big, we're going to have these things that people can see, but we're going to charge them so they can see it. So we're going to take something from the natural world that we didn't create at all. It's something purely from nature. And we're going to put a gate to it so people have to pay for it. Another duality that is important is the feminine-male duality. And it shows in the couple between Sattler and Dr. Grant. So two doctors, both specialists of knowledge, but they come at knowledge and they come at their actions through various paths. And Sattler is more a feminine path, whereas Dr. Grant goes at it from a self-doubting path. So Dr. Grant, always questioning, reflective, good at teaching. He's introduced from the start as being a professor on the field doing digs and teaching to children or adults, young adults. So very good at teaching, yet he has a defect and he has an excess within it, which is that he doesn't want children. That is presented as a problem from the start, where Sattler wants children and she's less self-doubting. He's always self-doubting because anytime he touches something, he says, did I break it? Did I break it? Did I break the car? Did I break the computer that's digging? Whereas Sattler is more confident and intuitive. Whereas Dr. Grant reaches higher levels of understanding and knowledge, but he does so always in a self-doubting way. So here you can see the trade-off and the excess. If you're intuitive and confident, like the lady, you're going to be too much out there. You're going to put yourself too much at risk. And she puts herself too much at risk. And in fact, the ranger dies because of her, ultimately. Which ties back to what she has said, dinosaur eats man, woman inherit the earth. So she is sacrificing man for her boldness and for her instinct. But she does so, of course, to save people. So she has to do it in a way. But by stepping forward so much, she is always putting herself at risk, whereas Dr. Grant is the most intelligent, the one capable of not moving in front of a pissed off T-Rex, the one who knows how the velociraptors behave, and so he could, in principle, escape them. But he is the opposite of Dr. Sadler in terms of maternal instinct. She wants children. She wants to care for the Triceratops. She wants Dr. Grant to be surrounded by children. She wants Dr. Grant not to scare the young fat child at the beginning with a story of the raptors. So she's always there softening Dr. Grant. Dr. Grant doesn't want children. He thinks he hates them. And that excess will be... So in a movie, you either die by your excess, or the director will have to do a path of redemption for your excess. So his excess, Dr. Grant, was self-doubt. The very kind of self-doubt that leads him to be particularly insightful in science, but that leads him to be incapable of interacting with technology, one, and two, to self-doubt about his capacity to be a savior and a provider for children. And he's going to have redemption in those two domains, particularly with the children, because there will be a path for him to eventually become extremely protective of the two children, so kind of adoptive children of the movie, who are the grandchildren of Hammond. So Dr. Grant is the main character of the movie, precisely because he basically grows into a father that he didn't want to be. Ian Malcolm, one of the most hilarious, spectacular character of the movie, a man who is, I believe he is put in duality with Hammond. So I believe that the leader of the park is the duality to pay attention to with respect to Malcolm. And at some point in the movie, Hammond says it explicitly. He says, "I hate this man." And normally when you do this in a movie, you are developing the ultimate nemesis, the ultimate contrary. So this guy presents himself as a bizarre mind, kind of chaotic mind type of mathematician, a chaotician, always on the flirt with intelligence and the lines with strange attractors. With Dr. Sadler, and he's trying to pick up Dr. Sadler right in front of her husband, or you could say boyfriend. I don't know if they're married. He's the most hilarious character in this movie. He's very fun. But here's the contrast with Hammond. See, Hammond is pursuing a form of narcissistic self-elevation where he wants to impress people with reality. But Hammond already has something very real in his life. He has grandchildren. Therefore, he has children. So Hammond is out there trying to conquer a chaotic world of reality and entertainment, when in fact he has already all of the ingredients to be happy. And we'll see it at the end of the movie in the helicopter. He has everything to be happy. He doesn't need the dinosaurs. The dinosaurs are a ridiculous pursuit. He has his two grandchildren. They're safe. And it doesn't even matter that other people died, that the lawyer died, that it doesn't matter. He has everything already, but he's out there on the pursuit. Whereas Ian Malcolm is in the search for an ex-Miss Malcolm, as he calls her. So constantly in disappointment, he hasn't been successfully producing children. He hasn't been successful in his romantic endeavors. And so he is doing exactly the opposite as Hammond. Hammond has the children already. He wants more. He wants out there. He wants reality and entertainment. Yeah, Malcolm is out there in the chaotic world of chaos mathematics, but he doesn't have the happiness secured already. He is in pursuit of the happiness, which is why he always has to be so flirty. And then we have the final two characters that form a pair. Tim and his sister, I believe I have her names noted somewhere, but his vegetarian sister. So they also form a pair, and they completely mirror the pair between Dr. Sadler and Dr. Grant. So it's a male-female pair, both extremely knowledgeable, but in their own way. The guy is extremely knowledgeable about dinosaurs, just like Dr. Grant, extremely self-doubting, just like Dr. Grant. So his self-doubt will lead to excess when he gets stuck in the car and he doesn't want to move, and he says something like, I peed my pants or something. So self-doubt, shame, exactly what drives Dr. Grant toward knowledge. Whereas the girl is exactly like Dr. Sadler, pursuing her instinct. So she sometimes her instinct is in excess. It guides her to be afraid of the brachiosaurs, whereas you don't have to be afraid, they're vegetarian. And she follows her instinct in computer programming so that she's able to completely restore the security system and protect her family, the family and the people from the Velociraptor. So just like Sadler, extremely knowledgeable, but driven by kind of protective instinct into her hacking of computers rather than in, by pure knowledge. So that's what we have to start with, the structure of the characters. And note that flaws will be exploited across the movie as I describe the sequence of scenes. I've been noting basically everything that happens in the movie, and we'll walk through it and what it means. So the first scene, of course, is the trauma of the ranger. I've seen death. A Velociraptor has killed one of my employees. I've seen how they felt. How they felt like they were plotting, like they're figuring things out. And this scene is also important to tell you there were signs. From the start, nature was sending you a signal. Making dinosaurs is not a good idea. It will lead to human death. It led to one human death at the beginning, but it could lead to the death of all. Then we jump to the crystal discovery scene. So here we start being introduced at the technicals. And here it's a scene for the introduction of the lawyer. So the lawyer is worried. The mine is working on getting these mosquitoes stuck in amber to extract the blood. And the lawyer is pressing for an audit. And he's like, and eventually the mining guy, which I believe is in the region of Costa Rica, or maybe they're elsewhere. But he says, you know, Hammond likes me. Hammond doesn't like audits like you. Hammond doesn't like lawyers that are telling him he can't do something. He likes a miner like me because I'm mining the mosquitoes and I'm telling you, yes, we can. So that's the contrast between, you can already develop a psychology of Hammond based on this, which is he's a guy who doesn't like obstacles. He has lots of money. He wants to fund this thing to the maximum. No expense spared, he says all the time. That's his mood of kind of psycho CEO type of realization. Marby Dog says, the girl's name is Lex. I just looked it up. Yeah, Lex, that's true. So then we have the introduction of Dr. Grant and Dr. Sadler. They are just old. Well, he is old. As she was pointing out, in a more recent interview, they've been commenting back on this. And she was like, I was something like 24 years old, and I was with a husband in the movie that's like 50 years old. She commented on this recently in an interview. Well, recently, maybe a couple of years ago. And she was saying in the interview, back then, we didn't even think about the fact that it was kind of weird. So it's interesting, the changes of mores and judgment. Because, yeah, you know, I don't remember anyone in the 90s saying, oh, it's a pedo movie because she's just 25 and he's 50. No one has thought this. And yet in modern times, you have all these precautions that are taken not to awaken this kind of potential interpretation of the movie. But that was beautiful. It was beautiful that you could do that in the 90s. And yes, you know, it makes sense. That is how the university works. You know, it's these young girls who have a hero, and yes, you teach them and you guide them toward the PhD, and you also fuck them. That's just how it is. There's nothing more, you know, female wetting than knowledge and authority. So when you have knowledge and authority, the movie will the ladies will just walk to you and they will be like, oh, can you take care of me? And very quick, it's going to get into a bed. So that makes sense. It's a correct representation of science, and it worked. You know, she is extremely desirable, extremely thin white woman, beautiful. And the thing is that Dr. Grant is basically failing at inseminating her. That's the whole problem of this movie. And eventually, through a kind of psychological readiness, a psychological preparation of Dr. Grant through the two kids that aren't his, who, by the way, are products of divorce, at least in the book. I don't know if it's explicitly mentioned in the movie, but they are products of divorce, and so they lost their family. And on the Jurassic Park Island, Dr. Grant and Dr. Sadler will become their family and their protectors. So there's an extreme family theme to Jurassic Park. Then we have the appearance of John Hammond. And this is where Dr. Grant says, the kids, they're noisy, they're expensive, they smell. So he's framed at the start with this problem. He doesn't like kids. And this is actually an addition in the movie. This was not in the book. Apparently in the book, he is good with children throughout. But in the movie, there was an additive tension added there for eventually an opportunity for redemption. Now, John Hammond, the spectacular old guy who runs Jurassic Park, shows up in spectacular, eccentric fashion, invites himself into Dr. Grant's home. He opens the bottle himself. So you already have an eccentric symbol here, and a guy who enters the scene in his own way. Dr. Hammond, not Dr. Hammond, but John Hammond doesn't take obstacles. He just shows, and his money allows him to have a red carpet for him anywhere he goes. And eventually, when Dr. Grant and Dr. Sadler realize who this guy is, he's been funding their own research for years. They suddenly become extremely respectful and reverent. He convinces them to come onto the island by saying, I will fund your research for 3 more years if you can just come a couple of days to the island. Eventually, there's a conflict in the there's kind of tensions developing in the helicopter, because you have Ian Malcolm, who's on flirt mode, and Hammond says, I bring scientists, you bring a rock star, because of that, of Dr. Malcolm's behavior, which is a rock star behavior with a leather jacket. And then we have immediately the iconic first sight of the dinosaur, the Brachiosaurus, with Dr. Grant with his glasses. He kind of removes them clumsily. And this is one of the most beautiful aspects of this movie, the contrast between inanimate and animate, and the contrast between fossils and action. This metaphorical allegory around fossils, paralysis, not movement, animate, inanimate, is extremely strong in the movie. And you can feel the emotion of Dr. Grant so much stronger, because, you know, Hammond, okay, he finds the dinosaurs cute. He wants to be there when they're born, and he takes care of them. And the scientists, they're probably also impressed by the dinosaurs when they first see them. But to have Dr. Grant here, this is a guy who's been fascinated at dinosaurs and thinking about dinosaurs all day, all of his life. And now he sees them alive, and that is the most emotional contrast you can get. This is what this movie does so well. Then second layer of contrast, because contrast, theory versus praxis, says Marby Dog. That is another theme that is absolutely present. Precisely because You know, Dr. Sadler has her hand into the shit of the Triceratops. And you have Ian Malcolm saying, I hope you're going to wash your hands before you eat anything. So Ian Malcolm is approaching everything theoretically. Dr. Sadler is approaching everything intuitively and with the physics of it and the reality of it. And she doesn't mind putting her hands in the pile of shit. So you have a second layer of contrast, which is the paleobotanist aspect. So she's there in the Jeep, Dr. Sadler, and she's like, I can't believe it. This plant has been extinct for 100 million years. And then Dr. Grant is like, no, please look here. And then she's like, she suddenly sees the Brachiosaurus. And that's also interesting, which is you have a woman here who's been specifically specialized on plants, and even her art of a paleobotanist will leave aside the plant that is extinct to be more impressed by the Brachiosaurus, of course. So they have resuscitated these plants and these dinosaurs, but of course the dinosaurs, even for a woman who's fascinated at plants, even the dinosaurs at the end are more interesting. So you get the educational tour. You get already a mention of one of the themes of the movie, which is extinction and disappearance. So Dr. Grant says, I think we're out of job. And Malcolm says, don't you mean extinct? So that is a theme that is constantly coming back in the movie. The idea that sometimes your time passes, and it passes quicker than you would think. And life passes quicker than you would think. And it's never a good idea to think that you have time in life. Never. And the movie will show this in the most stunning scene. To me, this is probably one of the most important and the most ingenious scenes ever. And it lasts about half of a second in the movie. Objects in the mirror are closer than they appear. For a fraction of a second in the movie, the T-Rex is pursuing the Jeep, and you see the camera turns, instead of looking at the T-Rex, the camera turns to the mirror. And on the mirror, you see the sentence that is printed on all mirrors in America. Objects in the mirror are closer than they appear. And this is so much compaction. This is so much genius. If the movie had been bad for other reasons, just this scene could rescue it. Because it means so many things at the same time. It takes the whole movie and it compacts it to a single sentence. And not only this, that single sentence is hilariously a random technical aspect of American life where, for some reason, this sentence is also printed on every mirror out there of every car. Objects in the mirror are closer than they appear. So this is telling you everything first about the duality of the movie. Dr. Grant is closer to Dr. Sadler than you would think. He says he doesn't like children, but down inside his heart, he can handle children. And in fact, he's going to save them multiple times. And he's going to be a good provider for them. Ian Malcolm is closer to John Hammond than you would think. The girl child is closer to her brother than you would think. The greedy liar is closer to Dennis than you would think. He does his own form of piracy through his corporate structuring and his gatekeeping. Everything in the mirror, this is so key. Everything in the mirror, so that means every character duality that you have in Jurassic Park, they are closer than they appear. They are not contraries. They are framed as contrary. They sometimes self-frame as contrary. But they are part of an ensemble that is actually joined and similar. That's just the first layer of analysis. And it's in relation to character mirroring in Jurassic Park. The second layer of objects in the mirror are closer than they appear is the time dimension. It's like, why are objects closer for the mirror? Well, it has to do with spatial dimension. But if you do this phenomenon in time, you will realize that the future is closer than it appears. The future is closer than it appears. Don't lose any time. And what this sentence is meant to worry about is if you're pursued by a car or a T-Rex, keep in mind that the car or the T-Rex is closer to you, closer to catching you. And ultimately, that's also death. And it's also technology. So AI is closer than you would think. The takeover of AI, of humanity by AI, is closer than you would think. Genetic modifications are closer than you would think. The future is closer than you would think, and death is closer than you would think. So that line is so, it captures everything so well in a way where you're like, how the fuck is that random? How can a random technical print on a mirror catch this movie so well? That you end up thinking, maybe the whole movie has been built around this, actually. Perhaps the first idea of Spielberg was, I'm going to build a movie around this mirror statement, and I'm going to make the whole movie around it. I'm going to build the characters. I'm going to take, of course, my inspiration from the book Jurassic Park, but I'm going to structure the whole movie around the duality proposed in this mirror sentence. Objects in the mirror are closer than they appear. And it's a reminder about life also. Don't spend so much time like Dr. Grant thinking that you shouldn't have babies, because you get a couple of shots of making babies in your life. If you don't take them, you have zero babies, and you're going to be older by the time you realize that you have no more shots. And this movie gives a shot to Dr. Grant because it puts a young female anthropologist or a paleobotanist of some sort, and it puts her available to him. All that needs to change is inside of him. His future is closer than it appears. The availability of pussy is closer to him than he would want to acknowledge. John Drake says it seems to be accelerating on top of it all. Absolutely, absolutely. Marby Dog says this was a very crucial part of the film. Death coming for us all must go faster. Absolutely. Don't lose a single day of your life. Pursue the maximal pursuit of your interest and pleasure, but not pleasure in the hedonistic sense, but pleasure in terms of pursuing happiness and pursuing realization of yourself. This movie is telling you this in so many ways. And then we end up in the educational tour, and we see the hubris of Hammond. You know, he has this whole video of himself, and it's himself being cloned. And it's like, this tells you, okay, the excess of Hammond is in narcissism, self-obsession. Ultimately, he doesn't care enough about his grandchildren that he has, which he should celebrate. He should just be sitting on that success. But no, he wants further. He wants a little video that shows copies of him, that interacts with him, and it's all within him. This movie tells you the problem is within the mind of Hammond. And it's a problem of a lack of growth into an adult. So John Hammond eventually will lay it out explicitly in the restaurant scene, alone with Dr. Sadler. The problem was that he had this flea circus. That was his first way of doing entertainment. Now, what is a flea circus? Apparently, it's some kind of English tradition, maybe wider than English, but the guy seems Scottish. And he has these... So a flea circus is like a little platform that an entertainer carries. And there are fleas that sometimes are real fleas, sometimes it's illusion, but they are attached to ropes, strings, and sometimes the strings are attached to some kind of little vehicle, miniature vehicle. And they either train the fleas or they make visual illusions and fake fleas. But in the end, it's the idea that these fleas are, which are small insects, they are carrying these little figurines around. And so that it makes it look like a living scene. I find the concept completely objectionable. Like, why are you torturing fleas or deceiving people with this fake magic? But apparently it was a thing in the 19th century. So Hammond was disappointed with his experience with the flea circus because he wanted to show something that was real. And here's another excess of Hammond. He pursues real so much. Objects are in the mirror are closer than they appear. They are more real than they appear. And you've pursued something just a little more real than the flea circus. There you are, having T-Rex and Velociraptor running after you to kill you. That's a little too real. That's a little closer than you thought it was. Death is closer than you thought it was. Then in that educational tour, you get the classic Life Finds a Way by Dr. Malcolm. Life will not be contained. It will spread, maybe dangerously, but there it is. So what did he mean by there it is? That's very important. What he's saying is there are obstacles that life works around in ways that you would never expect. And what he's saying is the dinosaurs have found a way to reproduce 200 or 100 million years into the future. What he's saying, there it is, look, sometimes the path is dangerous. So imagine the path for a dinosaur who wants to survive 100 million years into the future. That's 100 million years. How do I get there? Well, one way to get there would be to make babies, which this movie is all about this. But one way to get there would be to have your blood preserved in amber by a mosquito. And what Dr. Malcolm is suggesting is there it is. It has surpassed the obstacle of 100 million years. It has found the right path to reproduce 100 million years into the future, and it happens to be the manipulation of humans and the preservation of blood in a mosquito. That's what there it is mean. It means life doesn't take obstacles. And just like Hammond, in a way, life as presented in Jurassic Park is a mirror of Hammond. Because Hammond doesn't take obstacles. He drinks the wine that he wants to drink. He buys out scientists to come write reports about him. Hammond doesn't take obstacles, but life is so much beyond Hammond. Life is absolutely obsessed with continuing. And that's what will break Jurassic Park. It's the fact that their system to keep life from reproducing by declaring by making genetically all the dinosaurs female would eventually have a flaw. In this educational tour, you already see the exploitation of a flaw. The three professors are stuck in the ride belt, and the ride's belt imposes that they stay seated. They all take the ride belts and they lift them up, and it allows them to escape to go see the actual science happening in the lab. That's already the movie telling you there are human flaws in everything. And this scene is so precious because it tells you, wait a minute. How do you think you're going to keep dinosaurs captured if you can't even keep three scientists captured? See, these scientists are captured on the educational tour seats by Hammond, by a mechanism that he's built to keep them seated. And that's the narcissism of Hammond saying, please listen to me. Please see my whole park. Please see the educational tour we've prepared for you. But life finds a way. Life refuses obstacles, and everyone is like Hammond down the line. Everyone doesn't want obstacles to be imposed onto them, and so they free themselves from it by just pushing the belts up. And that's the whole metaphor for what the dinosaurs are going to do. Give me 30 seconds. I need to sneeze. I'll be back. All right. So the violation of flaws. Every human has a flaw. Hammond has a flaw. He wants to be listened to. He wants to impress. The professors don't care. They're going to be impressed by the actual science. We have very intense philosophical concerns. Malcolm says the lack of humility in front of nature is staggering. You wield genetic power like a child. You didn't earn the knowledge. You took it from others. Your scientists were so preoccupied with whether or not they could, they didn't stop to think whether they should. And that's an aspect of Jurassic Park that I like. It's, are things earned? So Dr. Sadler wants to have children from Dr. Grant. But to have children from Dr. Grant, she needs to convince him that he deserves children. So she has to earn this. She will earn this by familiarizing him with the other children, the grandchildren of Hammond. So she's earning her reproduction success with Dr. Grant by having to convince him. Now there's this idea, do you earn the money you have? Hammond is in conflict with Dennis, the fat coder. He's already paying him everything that he is owed. But Dennis wants more. Well, have you earned it? Or are you... Because if we have a deal on your salary, I'm just going to pay that salary. I'm not going to be subject to extortion where you're basically suggesting to me that you're going to mess up my computer system. I'm not going to be subject to extortion to give you more money. So the earning is very important. And Malcolm expands this idea into the domain of knowledge. And he's absolutely right. We have stopped earning knowledge. When the AI era has started now, it is no more an affair of a full lifetime of a scientist to be developing a theory. At this point, we have packaged knowledge in a black box. And that's post-Jurassic Park, of course, because it's happening now. But that is very dangerous because you lose control when you don't earn the thing. So it's like, yeah, okay, you can have a rough knowledge of if we patch all the DNA that way and we take some from the frogs, it's going to work. And down the line, it's a black box, but it leads to a freaking brachiosaurus. So who cares? Now, that's the problem. When you delegate, when you turn into a black box, you start misunderstanding the mechanism. That's why ecology is ultimately never understandable. You can never understand the whole black box of the whole thing. And that's exactly why Jurassic Park fails. So Malcolm is right. Because you didn't earn the knowledge, because you haven't reached omniscience of it, the full understanding of it, you forgot a flaw, and it led the scientists to be able to break your ride, and it led the Jurassic Park dinosaurs to be able to break your electrical wires and all. And you forgot the big flaw of your own coders that are greedy like life. They are as greedy as life. They don't like obstacles. They think they deserve more. Another comment by Malcolm is, nature selected dinosaurs for extinction. Discovery is a violent, penetrative act. What you call discovery, I call it rape of the natural world. I love this sentence. You will have heard me in my life do many sentences of that kind. I love the way Malcolm overlaps between flirtiness and sexual talk and deep scientific insight. So he's saying it's the rape of the natural world. And it's true. You know, the natural world had settled the dinosaur issue. And it's nothing else. What Hammond has done is nothing else than unconsensual sex, basically. He has made a genetic mix, so basically dinosaur babies, with he happens to have made it with complementary frog DNA, but that's what he could find. But it's effectively meiotic rape. He's been taking eggs and sperm and implanting them with a genetic code that they weren't meant to carry. That they were not meant to carry. Or maybe the egg was implanted. But no matter what he did, he reproduced with a dinosaur from 100,000 years from 100 million years ago. Now there's a reversal happening in the movie. The skeptics become non-skeptic and the non-skeptic become skeptics. So the liar is the blood-sucking liar who was there for the audit, ends up being super enthusiastic, whereas the scientists who have more knowledge but less greed, they end up being less enthusiastic. So you can see here the asymmetry of knowledge contributing to character evolution, which is, oh, well, when you have a lot of knowledge but not a lot of greed, you might be open. Oh, yeah, a park. Okay, let's go see. Oh, wow, dinosaur. Wow, that is fascinating. I've always dreamed about dinosaurs. But eventually, when the greed take over, the liar becomes, oh, we're going to make money with this. Whereas the scientists are like, whoa, 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 this is much bigger than we expected. I know Velociraptors. One of the most marking comments of Dr. Grant is, you bred raptors? And he seems to be the only one in the room, like, understanding the consequences of this. Perhaps with the ranger, because he's seen them before. But in all this room, you have enthusiastic scientists, you have this Chinese guy who's just like, yeah, we bred raptors. But he knows, well, if you've awakened the raptor, I know that it's going to go bad. There's feminism inserted as a theme in the movie. There's two places where feminism is extremely present. And I'm not saying I'm a feminist, but we do have to track this movie and understand how are they doing it so well to make a movie that is so interesting and yet to be injecting those leftist themes to it. The first place where feminism clearly happens is when Malcolm says God creates the dinosaurs, God destroys the dinosaurs, God creates man, man destroys God, man creates the dinosaurs eat, and so that's his sentence. And then Dr. Sadler says, dinosaurs eat man, woman inherit the earth. So here you have a sequence of creation and destruction of between God and man and dinosaurs. But in the end, she's right. Woman inherit the earth. Now, woman cannot do without men, but they can dispose of a lot of men. And this is what actually will happen in the movie, where men are being the shields for protecting the woman and the children. So Dr. Sadler is surviving because of the ranger dying. She is surviving because the ranger was focused on one Velociraptor but couldn't see the other two coming. The other place where feminism clearly appears in the movie is when the young girl ends up solving the issue of the Unix security system. They are stuck in the control room, which, by the way, this control room is a joke. The name of it, the control room, it's a powerful, powerful reference. Because the whole movie is about chaos, and it's about the fact that you don't control, that the control is the illusion. Even Dr. Sadler says it explicitly. It's still the flea circus. The fact that you control it is your illusion. The idea that you control it is your illusion. And yet they're in the control room, as if in a chaotic situation like this, any control was possible. And the young girl who is the hacker, while the people are trying to block the door for the raptor not to enter, the young girl succeeds at solving the computer system's problems and restores security so that the door can be locked strongly. Now, at the moment where she succeeds, you will see it's a fraction of a second. At the moment where she succeeds, we see the desk of Dennis, the fat coder. And we see that he has his soft porn bikini woman image on the computer. And as she presses enter to enter her final orders to the computer, not only does she resolve the window that has the security issue, you can see a disappearance of the bikini soft porn image of Dennis. And this is telling you, this is the moment where the movie is telling you, women are taking over. Women inherit the earth. Women have become better hackers than men. Now, it's not true. That moment never happens for real in reality. But it is a feminist moment of the movie where it happens in the movie. And it's telling you, I am no more a product of attention because of my boobs. I'm now the savior of humanity. I'm the savior. I'm the one who found how to resolve the Linux system. Now we have security. It's very important that the porn image disappears at this time. And they make it flash out, literally, of the computer. And that tells you what the intent was at the Spielberg level. He was saying, not only are we extinct in the face of AI, not only are we extinct already in the face of upcoming genetic modification, we are extinct. The base male is extinct already in front of the rising force of professional corporate woman. Now, absolutely delusional and not true. But that was the mindset of Spielberg as he introduces that scene. We are no more objects of sexual desires. We are becoming something bigger, the saviors of humanity. Something, a very common belief in the 90s. Now we know that women can't save humanity. In fact, they can mess it up pretty hard. DK Shadow says, what the movie is telling you is don't trust fat IT admins. Absolutely. Absolutely. Other interesting aspects quickly before we conclude. The DNA ACGT ceiling. There's a ceiling made with single letters ACGT. And it's eventually there's light and it comes down onto the raptor. So you see the raptor made up of light, of ACGT. That is so beautiful and so powerful. Because it's putting a lot of contrast that belong to the movie. First, the contrast of, yes, we are made of DNA. So obvious. Yes, these dinosaurs are made of a DNA technology that allowed restoring them. But even more powerfully, it shows the contrast between the entertainment intent of the Jurassic Park. It's like, oh, you wanted to make a cute set of letters in the lights of the roof so that kids can walk around and see, oh, ACGT. But now this light is reflecting onto a raptor that wants to kill children. So this contrast is extremely comedic and interesting. And I've already talked about the nostalgia of Hammond, the girl computer fix, which is a feminist moment. An interesting montage. The scene where the raptors enter the kitchen and the kids are hiding in various metallic compartments. That is an extremely well-designed scene, and it's complex. It's stepwise, and it happens so fast that you don't, when you just watch relax without pausing or paying attention, you don't see the whole thing. But they make you understand through the camera movement that I'm about to develop an illusion. The illusion is going to fool the raptor, but it's also going to fool you, but I'm showing you all of it. That's what Spielberg is saying when he takes the camera and he shows the kids entering into a subspace under a sink or something. They close the door. And you see in that scene, in that very starting scene, the kids are entering the block and the Velociraptor is there. So it's showing you the actual orientation of how the kids will be with respect to the Velociraptor. But then the camera turns. Now you see the reflection of the kids closing the door. And that's telling you, this is my first step of the illusion. I've just changed the actual kids for the reflection of the kids. And then the camera jumps to the face of the raptor. And it's telling you, now I'm showing you the observer that will be fooled by this illusion. And then the raptor starts running, and then you start having the whole illusion scene. Where the raptor is running toward the children, and oh my God, he's about to eat them. But no, he's running after the metallic reflection. And it's already been shown to you on the camera, but it's been shown so fast that you may not understand it. Eventually, you get to understand it at the same time as the raptor collides with a plaque of metal. And that is very important. First, extremely well done cinematography and showing you all of the illusion and yet making it believable enough that you think, maybe the raptor is going to catch these children. And also, it's a comment on evolution and preparedness of pre-evolved settings and non-pre-evolved settings. This movie, of course, is about evolution a lot. And this scene shows you what happens when, you know, the raptors, they have general knowledge and general intelligence, allowing them, among other things, to resolve how to open doors. But they have never seen polished metal that gives a mirror effect. And they will be fooled by that. They will be fooled by that in the same way the bird descendants are fooled by glass sometimes. Sometimes a bird will just fly straight into a window and die from it. And it shows you the contrast between, you can have evolved a lot of intelligence, but if you haven't evolved that specific understanding that, yes, there are things that are so reflective that they can create the illusion that a prey is there, then you're not fit for the world still, not completely. You're going to make errors. There is a suggestion when Ammon says, are the children fine? And Dr. Grant says, the children are fine. And then you hear shotgun sounds and it's like, no! Hammond is like, no! And it's not clear there. Is he yelling no because he's scared for the children? Because we just said the children are fine. Or is it that he's scared that the shotgun is killing raptors? That is something that is clearer in the book. In the book, Hammond is really scared about, don't destroy my dinosaurs! Whereas in the movie, they leave it on the fence where, is he yelling no because he's scared that the children will die? Or is he yelling no because he's scared that the velociraptors will die? Because he's there for the birth of every dinosaur on the island. It's a level of care that he doesn't even seem to have given to his grandchildren. So there's this conflict of, is Hammond really, has he become too much of a father to the dinosaurs rather than to his own biological descent? The final scene, of course, let's close with this, but the final scene is so spectacular because it regroups all of the allegories that I've just been talking about. So you have archaeologists standing onto broken segments of a fossil. So you have the whole past, inanimate, current, animate. So you have an action scene built onto fossils. That's what's fascinating about it. This display of a fossil in the Jurassic Park was, of course, made by Hammond for spectacular display. So there's the spectacular action aspect of being run after by raptors while you're an archaeologist standing on a fossil. And this fossil has been deployed there for the purpose of entertainment. So you have the whole structure of the movie expressing itself in the final scene. And then you even have chaos, which is, well, they're climbing the fossils, escaping the raptors, but eventually they fall, they're stuck. Now the raptors are about to kill them. And what do you have saving them? The T-Rex comes in and eats the raptors. Mirroring what Dr. Sadler had been stating, dinosaur eats man, woman inherit the earth. Well, you can use that principle to say T-Rex eats raptors, humans survive. So there's, when you unleash the powers of nature, what this movie tells you is when you unleash the powers of nature will not only fight you, but because they're not that targeted, they're really just chaotic systems. They will also fight between one another. And so sometimes they have introduced this in the movie earlier where the T-Rex comes in and eats the herd animals, the herd dinosaurs that were threatening the kids and Grant. So they had already introduced the idea that nature is not just an enemy. Nature doesn't even want to kill you particularly, but nature is this chaotic force out there, and it's capable of killing for sure. And it might kill you, but it might also kill itself and fight against itself. That is what the movie finishes with, an absolutely spectacular scene. Not so much that the action is spectacular at the end, but just the fact of having old archaeologists, bone diggers, fighting over bones against the now alive raptors that they have been pursuing all of their life. The metaphorical strength here is super powerful. And then we end up in the helicopter and everyone is hugging each other. Grant is hugging the kids. So everything has been redempted, basically. Grant doesn't hate kids anymore. In fact, why would he have saved Timmy? If he truly hated kids, why not let him die? Well, it's because he doesn't truly hate them. He's been subject to redemption. Now he's going to be able to inseminate Dr. Sadler. He's hugging children. He loves them. Hammond is happy. His grandchildren have survived, even if others have died. And Grant looks at birds that are following the helicopter. And there you can see how having built the power of a knowledgeable character, you don't even need to say things in the movie anymore. You get it. Grant is thinking, oh my God, these birds are so much better than dinosaurs. They're flying beside us, and they are the descendants of the dinosaurs. So by the fact that you know that Grant has this theory from the very start of the movie, you can understand this scene as, oh, wow, how stupid are we to have tried to reawaken dinosaurs from the past when we had their descendants right here with us, and they're much more kind to us. They fly beside the helicopter pacifically. So all of it ultimately was not an error of nature. All of this is purely human flaw. The whole movie is human flaw, from the attempt to mess with Jurassic Park by the coder, the destruction of the security systems by the coder, the flaw of narcissism of Hammond, the human flaws of Grant in terms of not being fully and being able to protect and interact with children at first. All has been resolved now. It was all human flaws. The people who had these flaws have either died or have been fixed by what they saw. And you have basically 9 character arcs, each of whom has either died as they should because they weren't going to fix their flaws, or they have fixed their flaws and therefore they can move on with a more productive life. That is why Jurassic Park was the greatest movie, or one of the greatest movies of all time. And they don't make movies like this anymore these days. We have to train the youth somehow to start writing better movies. George says, we are stupid, JF. Look at how our countries got conquered. Well, yes. I wouldn't say that means we are stupid. We are incapable of control. That is the correct word. It's exactly what's happening in Jurassic Park. There's lots of intelligent characters in Jurassic Park, but they are intelligent enough to know we don't have control of these things. We don't control the full system of electricity, and we can lose control of it in certain circumstances. We don't control the ecology of an all-female, partly frog, partly dinosaur population. So yes, we are not stupid. We are intelligent, and we can see it. However, we have a lack of control sometimes, and it's political control in that case. That is it for tonight, boys. Thank you very much for being with me. I'm continuing my last review of White People Food. It's looking good, and soon I should also receive my early author copies. This will also give me visual feedback on if there are things that need fixing. And I have one more recipe that I've decided to add, and it's going to be Irish bacon and cabbage. because I knew that something Irish was needed. I originally thought I would do the Irish beef brisket and Guinness beer, but eventually I researched the meal and I found out that the meal has an origin, and the true origin is the genuine Irish cabbage and bacon, and that is the national meal of the national dish of Ireland. And I realized, wow, I realized so much about this meal, which I didn't know about at all. Basically, I was exposed to the beef Americanized version of the meal, which is also Irish American. But I realized so much things by building this last page for the book. Holy shit. I realized there's two meals that I really like in life, which is the Irish brisket. The Irish brisket boiled in Guinness beer, and the duck in a can of Martin Picard at Le Pied de Cochon. So that's a duck with foie gras in a can that they just dropped onto your plate. And I realized at the last minute writing the book, I realized that my two fascination with these two meals actually boils down to an Irish tradition, which is Irish bacon and cabbage. Because in the duck in a can of Martin Picard, he puts Savoy cabbage. And I've always been wondering, where does that come from? Why cabbage? Why does he put balsamic vinegar in it? And then I realized, holy shit. He was inspired to create a duck version of the classic Irish meal. And so now I have a full genetic history of why these two meals came to me as an American guy. Well, a Canadian, of course, but on the continent of America. And the reason, ultimately, that these two meals imported these techniques is an original traditional meal from Ireland, bacon and cabbage. I think it will be one of the most fascinating pages of the book. Much love, everyone. And we are totally on schedule. We might be able to have the book out to you by September, maybe, because I don't have much left to do. This is going to be publishable very soon. Now, I don't want to do it in August because I want to catch the drift of Christmas and the drift of fall. But I could do it in early September, possibly making it purchasable then, and we could do a big boom of sales in early autumn. That is it for tonight. Much love, and I'll see you all tomorrow.